Radio Prague News.
Prime Minister Petr Nečas has promised to push ahead with reforms aimed at reducing the gap in public spending. According to the governor of the Czech National Bank, the Czech Republic will not be ready to adopt the euro before 2017. And Charter 77 Week has kicked off in Prague. The centre-right government will press ahead with reforms aimed at reducing the deficit in public spending, Prime Minister Petr Nečas said in an address to the annual Jofin Economics Forum in Prague. In the years 2013-2014, the government aims to bring the deficit in public spending under 3% of GDP, and if the economy grows, the country could achieve a balanced budget by 2016. Mr. Nečas said that pushing through austerity measures to achieve this was a thankless task which undermined the cabinet's popularity with the public, but he said he was determined to see it through. The 129th Jofin Forum is focusing on the state of the Czech economy, the government proposed reforms for the coming years and their possible impact. Likewise, speaking at the Jofin Forum, the governor of the Czech National Bank, Miroslav Singer, said that in his view, the Czech Republic would not be ready to adopt the euro before 2017. He said that a serious debate on euro adoption could start in 2014 or 15, once the country had got its own finances in order, and expected negotiations to last approximately 2 years. Although the Czech Republic has not set a target date for euro adoption, Prime Minister Nečas said that euro adoption was still on the agenda. A week of events marking the 35th anniversary of the Charter 77 Human Rights Manifesto has kicked off in Prague. The series of special events organised by former dissidents and Charter 77 signatories includes exhibitions, seminars and a series of special performances of the late Václav Havel's plays. A photo exhibition at the Piazza of the National Theatre is called Prague Through the Lens of the Secret Service and is a compilation of photographs the communist secret police made in the process of spying on and following dissidents. Charter 77 Week is also intended to honour the memory of philosopher and Charter 77 spokesman Jan Patočka, who became the first victim of the communist backlash against the Charter 77 manifesto. He was arrested and died of a stroke shortly after undergoing an 11-hour interrogation by the communist secret police. The legendary 1933 US Double Eagle, the most expensive gold coin ever sold on auction, is to be shown in Prague over the next 2 days. The coin, which is on a seven-nation European tour, arrived in Prague on Sunday amidst tight security. The coin is to be shown to the public on Tuesday and Wednesday at Prague's National Museum. This is the first time that a 1933 Double Eagle has been publicly exhibited in Europe, and the artifact has incited enormous interest. And finally, a quick look at the weather forecast. The grey and muggy weather with day temperatures around 10 degrees Celsius is expected to clear up in the next 2 days and give way to a bout of spring weather with sunshine and day temperatures reaching 19 to 20 degrees in places. I'm Daniela Lazarova, and that's the end of the news.
Hello and welcome to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. My name is Christian Falvey. Many thanks for tuning in. Today, Czech political leaders offer varying interpretations on the left-wing victory in neighboring Slovakia, but agree there is a lesson to be learned. After that, we'll have a look at the week in sports. And in this week's interview program, we go back to the One World Film Festival to speak with documentary director Petr Lom about his films and what it was like to quit academia to pursue filmmaking.
When I was 35, I was a university professor and then decided to be a filmmaker. And it took a lot of internal courage to quit my job and just to go for it.
I hope you'll be staying with us today for all that and more here on Radio Prague. Voters in neighboring Slovakia made a powerful statement at the weekend when they handed an overwhelming victory to the center-left party Smer, which now has a strong enough mandate to form a single-party government. What that statement means, though, has been interpreted variously in the Czech Republic, where the current center-right government has reached record lows in popularity. In the view of Foreign Minister and Chairman of the Top 09 party, Karel Schwarzenberg, the poll should be a lesson for the Czech government that corruption doesn't pay, even amid positive right-wing policies. The Czech Social Democratic Party, on the other hand, was quick to interpret the election result as an indictment of failed policies that have often mirrored the reform measures passed and proposed in the Czech Republic. For an expert's view on both these statements, we turn to political analyst Jiří Pehe.
Well, I think that the results of the Slovak elections were actually reflected both trends that we hear about, that is, worries about corruption in Slovakia, which were so prominent in the affair called Gorilla. And then, of course, also the politics of the right-of-center government. I think that many Slovaks didn't actually vote just on the basis of their fears of corruption, because that would not explain why they in the end voted for Smer, which was also implicated in parts of the Gorilla affair.
Well, the outgoing Slovak government was also a right-wing coalition, but are there similar policies? Were there policies being implemented in Slovakia that reflect unpopular policies being pushed here in the Czech Republic?
Absolutely. I think that the right-of-center government in Slovakia pursued pretty much the same or very similar policies than that the Czech government pursues right now, although I would argue that the Slovak government was much more diplomatic in communicating with the public, and it was more skillful in introducing its reforms. But nevertheless, it was basically entirely swept away in the elections, which shows that people do not think that cuts and austerity measures are the only way towards solving the problems that we see in the current economic crisis.
Bohuslav Sobotka of the Social Democratic Party suggested that Prime Minister Nečas thoroughly study the situation in Slovakia. Do you think he will, or rather, do you think the government finds the election result in Slovakia at all frightening?
Well, I think that the Czech government should find the elections in Slovakia or the results of the elections in Slovakia frightening, simply because, in my opinion, there are lessons for Czech politics. It seems to me that if a right-of-center government wants to introduce reforms which put emphasis on cuts and austerity measures, it also needs to develop at least a sense of social coherence or some social policies which give people hope that they will not be left behind, and that these sometimes what is perceived as mindless cuts will not plunge too many people into poverty. And I think that this is what the Czech government has not been capable of doing, and I think that the Slovak government had similar problems. And in that respect, I think that the Czech government should learn from the lessons in Slovakia. Another problem of the Czech government has to do with corruption, and in that sense it is also similar to Slovakia, because the main argument of the opponents of cuts and austerity measures in both countries has been that people would accept government reforms more openly and with more enthusiasm if they knew that at the same time hundreds of millions of crowns are not lost in various corruption schemes. And both governments have not been able to fight corruption very successfully, and I think that this is now the result that we see in Slovakia, and in the Czech Republic we may expect something very similar.
That was political analyst Jiří Pehe. This is Radio Prague. Later on, we'll have our weekly interview program, One-on-One, but first, as always of a Monday, we'll have a look back at the news in sports, presented on this occasion by Jan Wellinger.
And we begin first with this. Runner Jakub Holuša pulled off the biggest triumph of his career so far at the weekend, clinching the lone Czech medal in the 800 meters at this year's World Indoor Championships in Istanbul. The last medal won by a Czech in the competition was bronze by Roman Šebrle 6 years ago, and Holuša went one better. Despite barely sleeping before the final, he told the Czech media he had weighed his chances of getting a medal, and it paid off in the race, in which regular favorites such as Kipalalat Lalang of Kenya and Marcin Lewandowski were absent. The Czech competitor went ahead with Ethiopian Mohamed Aman, and looked like he might even have a shot at gold. He was just edged for the medal. Even so, Hološa, wrapped up in the Czech flag after the race, was extremely happy with silver.
The celebrations are going to be wild back home in Opava. At least I hope so.
I'm headed there next weekend, so it's greetings to everyone, and I hope they wait for me to celebrate.
Hološa's silver place finish also means a win of $20,000, which the athlete said he'd probably invest in a new apartment. Turning to hockey now, the weekend saw plenty of action in the ČSKA Bojiškovna playoffs. Sparta Prague and Brno split the first two games of their series. Sparta lost the opener 4-3, but managed to edge Kometa 3-2 on Sunday and penalty shots. In other action, Plzeň have taken a 2-0 lead over Zlín, winning 3-2 on Saturday and dominating 5-1 a day later. Overseas in the National Hockey League, the Czech goalies Tomáš Vokoun and Michal Neuwirth were both flawless for the Washington Capitals this weekend, trading places to earn back-to-back shutouts. On Saturday, Vokoun blanked Boston, and a day later, Neuwirth kept Toronto off the scoreboard, earning his third shutout of the season. The final score there was 2-0. The team's coach, Dale Hunter, expressed satisfaction that he has two goalies he can start at the moment, always a good sign coming up towards the end of the regular season and the start of the playoffs. Washington are fighting for a place in the playoffs, currently in 15th spot in the league and 8th in the Eastern Conference. In football news now, Czech star midfielder Tomáš Rosický will stay on at Arsenal next year, having signed a new contract. Exact details, including the length he will stay with the club, have not been revealed, though. The deal comes after months of speculation over Rosický's professional future. In the autumn, he didn't play often, but has had a much more effective spring. Arsenal are pulling within fourth spot in the Premier League, which guarantees a berth in the Champions League. After signing, Rosický said he was proud to wear the club's jersey at the club's website. That's all the sport for today.
Jan Wellinger there with the news and sports. If you're just tuning in, then thank you for joining us. You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio. My name's Christian Falvey. In this week's edition of One on One, we speak to one of the jurors and guests of the One World International Human Rights Film Festival, currently on in Prague. Sara Borůvka meets with Petr Lom, a Czech-born documentary filmmaker.
The independent documentary director and producer Petr Lom was born in Czechoslovakia but spent most of his life abroad, in Canada and the US. His latest film, Back to the Square, was selected as the opening film at this year's edition of the One World International Film Festival, where he is also on the jury. Before becoming a filmmaker, Petr Lom was actually an academic, until one day he quit his job and never looked back. I asked him about his films, which focus, among other countries, on Iran and Egypt, his connection to the One World Festival, and about his big career change.
It's just personal projection because it took me a long time to get the courage to make the switch myself. So when I was 35, I was a university professor and then decided to be a filmmaker. And it took a lot of internal courage to quit my job and just to go for it. So I try to encourage people who might be going through the same thing.
And right now your focus are documentaries. You're a documentary filmmaker, and I've noticed a lot of your films also deal with the Middle East. Is there a reason for that?
It started out really as serendipity circumstances. I was working as an academic in Budapest and for George Soros's university, and I had a chance to travel to all Central Asia. So my attention then would focus on Central Asia, and from there gravitated to China, and then my work in Iran was for personal reasons. I have many Iranian friends, and then from that it was just a step to Egypt, so it's kind of just that's the way life's evolved.
And you have a PhD in political philosophy. Does that help you at all in approaching your subjects or dealing with the topics you deal with?
Maybe it prevents me from being stupid. No, I think I was studying and working on basically philosophical foundations under human rights issues. So now I'm working on the practical issues of human rights. So there's a continuation, sure.
And do you ever miss academics, or are you glad you left when you did?
No, of course, there's you always miss things when you leave things because everything has its pluses and minuses. I miss teaching a lot, and of course, and having the all the free time to study intensely things. So sure, I miss that. But on the other hand, it's lovely to do the job I do now, is to be more practical and creative things, to be more engaged with the world.
And let's talk a bit about your personal history. I believe you're Czech, but you spent large amounts of your life in Canada and the U.S. What is your family story?
I was born in 1968 in May during the Prague Spring, and after the Russians invaded, we immigrated to England. So my life has been, like most people in the Czech Republic of that generation, fundamentally marked by injustice. So not so much in my life, but certainly in my parents' life. You know, immigration is difficult for everybody. So I think that's at least one reason why I focus on issues of injustice in general in my films, I think, yeah.
And your latest film, Back to the Square, deals with the upheavals and the situation in Egypt in general. What led you to this specific topic?
Yeah, I'd finished a film about the Iranian regime of Ahmadinejad in 2009, and then I had a conversation with a producer about future subjects, and he recommended that I start following what Dr. Mohammed Al-Baradei, who was the UN Nuclear Inspection Agency chief in the Iraq War and who won a Nobel Peace Prize for his work in resisting the U.S. invasion, what he was saying about reform in Egypt already in 2010, predicting that the Mubarak's regime would fall and that political reform was necessary. So I was able to get access to him. And then when the revolution broke out, I followed him to Egypt. And then the focus of the film just shifted towards ordinary people as the film progressed. But that was the initial reason to go to Egypt.
That's fascinating that you knew about it so early on or were ahead of the curve there. Last night, this film was also shown at the opening. Did you have a chance to talk to the audience and maybe get some reactions, and how was that?
Yeah, it was wonderful. One World is one of my favorite festivals in the world. I've been here 4 times now, and what's special about it is that I think it's just because it's the People in Need organization runs it, and because it's such an important organization here that there's always really big crowds, and particularly lots of young people who are very interested, engaged, and very outward-looking. So there's always a tremendous energy and enthusiasm in the audiences here, and that's very special. And the Q&As are always very long and very intense, where people are really interested in what's happening and really want to know. So that makes it, as a filmmaker, always a real pleasure to come here.
And let's talk a bit just about the logistics of filming Back to the Square. Certainly going into Egypt as an outsider, it must have been very hard to find your 5 protagonists who are so outspoken and so great. How did you go about that?
It just takes a lot of time. Initially, it took about 4 or 5 months to try to figure out what the focus of the film was, that we should focus on basic human rights abuse and lack of respect for human rights, and just the basic fact that people are living in fear of state-sponsored cruelty. But that took a long time to kind of focus on. Initially, there were lots of different stories. One's about political change, political candidates also following young Muslim brother, questions of religion. But then I just decided, no, I'm going to focus on these stories. And they just accumulated over time as the revolution, aftermath of the revolution progressed, and basically horrible things would continue to be happening. And so the stories just accumulated. But how did I find the people? Usually, like anyway, when you're a documentary filmmaker, you're just kind of looking all the time for stories. And some are in the media, like the story of Salwa, the young woman who had been subjected to a virginity test, or the story of the young boy that we found on from this Day of the Camel when these people went into the square to try to disrupt the revolution. So some of these stories were better known, at least initially reported quickly in the media, but not really followed, so you would really get to know the characters and their stories.
And are you at all concerned about the fate of your protagonists? Could appearing in the film be dangerous to them?
We generally believe that actually appearing in a film is, this kind of film is, protect a person, because then their story becomes well known, and so it becomes, in a way, the publicity protects them. But the other fact is that we told them all what we're doing, and we'd like to respect their courage in wanting to speak out. But there are some things that you do change. For example, the couple that you meet outside the police station who've been wrongfully arrested, you know, the story becomes actually more interesting, because this is the same person who abused the husband in the prison is the police inspector who you meet in the previous scene, and their character names the police inspector later, but we, you know, edit that out because that's not a good idea to really make that link in the film.
And how do you view the situation in Egypt right now?
For very difficult. There's a lot of disillusionment a year after the revolution that things really haven't changed, that the liberal democracy they've been hoping for hasn't really happened, or that there's no transparency, corruption continues, and the police and military brutality continues, and then that the army still seems to be holding on to power. So it's very difficult. But on the other hand, the country is, you know, the majority of the country is aged under 30, full of young people, and their energy and revolutionary demand still, that's really not going to go away.
And your previous film, as you already mentioned, was dealing with Iran, it was dealing with Iranian president, and was titled Letters to the President. It was a bit controversial, and you were, some people said you weren't critical enough. There's two points I want to ask you about. One, how do you feel about that? And two, was it because it wasn't so controversial that you maybe got access where other foreign filmmakers did not get access?
The Iranian film, the controversy was kind of an artificial one, whipped up initially by some Iranian expats living in Berlin before the premiere of the film who hadn't seen the film, and they were really looking for an excuse to get angry. Ahmadinejad is such a hot-button subject in general that, as is Iran, particularly in the U.S., where there's, in the U.S., it's you know, basically enemy number one of the United States now, so if you challenge this caricature of Iran being as the evil empire, then people will naturally get upset, because they have, unfortunately, often a vested interest in keeping this enemy, this illusion of this enemy intact in their minds. But the way I usually work is to try to make complex films which aren't dogmatic. And so the way the film, this Iranian film, the narrative arc worked was by initially showing you the propaganda machine and just letting you into it. So you this film begins and you think I'm presenting Ahmadinejad the way he wants you to understand him, is that he's wonderful and a real populist who is loved by his people. But as the film progressed, that image is undermined as further and further, so you understand the lying and the hypocrisy of the regime. So you'd have to basically watch the whole film to understand the picture.
And again, may I ask you, have you been keeping a close eye on the latest developments in Iran because of your connection to the country? And what is your take on the big question whether the situation will escalate further or not?
I feel that the film I made in 2009 is still as timely as ever. I made a film then. One of the reasons was because there was a lot of back then talk about bombing Iran during the U.S. elections. And that hasn't changed, actually. There's the same message now, and it seems actually even more worrisome. So one of the reasons why I made the film was to show you that who you'd be bombing, that ordinary Iranians are people too. Even though it's such a primitive thing to even have to say. But it's similar to what I said to earlier. It's so easy to hate an enemy that has no face, or whose stories you don't understand, or are able to sympathize or understand their common humanity. It's a real worry. On the other hand, the regime of Ahmadinejad is now clearly much worse than it appeared to be when I was making the film in 2008. That it really, it's a regime now that's clearly an emperor with no clothes that is really governing just through brutality, right? So I'm extremely concerned what's happening within Iran. Yeah, and certainly worry that it's going to escalate into some kind of armed conflict before the U.S. election by September, October. So, yeah, it's a big worry, yeah.
And now to make quite a thematic leap, but still, what are you looking forward to during the UN World Festival, and what are your plans for after the festival?
Well, I'm honored to be on the jury this year, so we're watching films all week. So I think we're watching 15 or 16 films, so it's a quite intense week, but it's quite special to be able to do that, especially when you finish the film now, is that you clear your head and watch other people's work and try to get inspired for new ideas and new projects. So, but I'm working on another film now on Egypt still with my partner, who was in Egypt together with me all year. And so we're now editing together her film, which is about five young Egyptian women who are artists. So we're following how a young woman's identity is being transformed as a result of the revolution. So it's a much more intimate feminine film, really. So we hope we can come back with it to One World next year.
Sarah Barufka there talking to documentary filmmaker Petr Lom for that edition of One on One. Topping off our show now for today is the next edition of our language learning series, The ABCs of Czech, brought to you by Pavla Horáková and Vladimír Tax.
Yes, it's time to take a look at another farm animal and the tracks it has left on the Czech language. Although lamb and mutton is not as popular in this country as, for example, in Britain, Czech is still rich on sheep idioms. The word
ovce
is both the generic term and the female sheep. An endearing term for a little sheep is
ovečka,
but also
beránek,
which literally means a small ram, while an adult ram, in other words, a male sheep, is
berán.
All those words will appear in today's program. The sheep, or
ovce,
is a symbol of stupidity and gullibility. It is applied to people who are easily led and act as they are told without thinking. But alas, if someone does not behave exactly like the rest of the flock, they are immediately labeled as a black sheep.
Černá ovce.
When Czechs are talking about sheep, as in the timid, defenseless, innocent creature which is often preyed upon, they use the word
beránek,
meaning lamb or little ram. If someone is as meek as a lamb, Czechs say
má beránčí povahu.
He has the character of a lamb.
Má beránčí povahu.
The biblical symbol, the Lamb of God, was translated into Czech as
beránek boží,
or God's lamb. The Lamb of God who takes away all the sins. That metaphor originates in the ancient practice of sacrificing live animals. A sacrificial lamb is
obětní beránek.
That expression in Czech also stands for a scapegoat.
Obětní beránek.
An evil person who pretends to be innocent can be referred to as a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Vlk v rouše beránčím.
Literally, a wolf in lamb's attire.
Vlk v rouše beránčím.
A fluffy little lamb can grow up into a big fat ram, a symbol of obstinacy in Czech.
Být tvrdohlavý jako beran.
To be as stubborn as a ram. Interestingly, translates into English as stubborn as a mule or pig-headed.
Být tvrdohlavý jako beran.
And finally, sheep, as described by the term
ovečky,
means a group of people under the shepherd-like care of God or under the charge of a parish priest, the flock. Someone who has strayed from God's way is
zbloudilá ovečka,
a stray sheep. Just out of interest, Czechs too count sheep when they can't fall asleep. To count sheep,
počítat ovečky.
I only wonder what kind of sheep priests count when they go to sleep. Anyway, that's it for today. Until next time, ba-ba.
That was Pavla Horáková and Vladimír Tax with the ABCs of Czech, wrapping up Radio Prague's English program for today. Don't forget that this program and every other is available at our internet address, radio.cz. If you have any questions or comments, we are always happy to hear them. You can contact us by email at english@radio.cz, on Facebook or Twitter under Radio Prague, or of course by post to Vinohradská 12, 12099, Prague. From me, Christian Falvey, thanks for listening.